Hey, this is Grace Lee. If you like viewers like us, then you'll want to check out another podcast by some friends of ours, Self-Evident. It tells true stories about everyday life in Asian America and gets to the tough questions about who we are and where we're going. Self-Evident has just launched a new season, starting with a two-part story about Asian and Black women trying to remove a white nationalist from their local farmers market. So take a listen wherever you get podcasts. Just search for Self-Evident, Asian America's Stories. Previously on Viewers Like Us.
We don't get that many opportunities as men of color, as Native Americans. We don't get to step outside of those lines without the consequences coming slamming down on our head.
And these were well-educated people. They were capable of contributing so much, but they were continually reminded that they were tokens.
We had a whole team of people that looked like America because he said, I want to make sure that all of our perspectives are there.
I've invited PBS President and CEO Paula Kerger several times to talk with me for this podcast. She passed me on to her chief programming executive, Sylvia Bug, who agreed to talk on the record. But after listening to the first episode, they declined to go forward with an interview. We won't really know whether PBS is meeting its mission to reflect and serve the American public without relevant data, transparency, and accountability from system leaders. This starts by having open conversations that result in tangible actions and measurable goals. But conversations with PBS leaders are hard to come by. I know because I've tried for months. Akintunde Ahmad, who's reporting on this series, also fielded a few rejections,
including one from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Initially, they told me to check out the DEI statement on their site. But after I followed up with some written questions, CPB President Pat Harrison mentioned a possible meeting, quote, after the holidays.
We'll keep you posted on that. Honestly, I don't understand why they don't want to talk to me. I'm not a gotcha journalist. Most of my creative output has landed on PBS. I've gone through its producer's workshop and spread the gospel of why public television matters. Because I believe in the mission. And it's not just me. As we've heard throughout this series, many BIPOC creators have dedicated their time, talent, and commitment to keep PBS's mission on track. And I know so many people who work inside the system who've done the same. We all care about public media. So why is this so hard?
I'm disappointed that more leadership aren't wanting to speak to you about this.
That's Dasha Mitchell. She heads Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at KQED in San Francisco. When Tunde couldn't get anyone from CPB to talk to us, he reached out to his local public media station.
Cool. We're rolling now. There we go.
Mitchell said something we've thought about often while making this podcast.
My question to them directly is, what are you afraid of? Answer the question. I'll wait, right? I know you may need some time, but what are you afraid of being exposed? You cannot move through fear without naming it. And if you are unwilling to answer it, public media will not last. Real talk. Because we are at the point now where Black and brown folks, there are some folks who were in it, we're doing the work, but like there are enough of us that are leaving that are done.
Welcome to Viewers Like Us, where we investigate the growing gap between PBS and its founding mission and ask, what would it take to restore the public to public television? I'm your host, Grace Lee. It's been over a year since I first wrote an essay that critiqued inequities at PBS and questioned its over-reliance on one white male filmmaker to tell America's stories.
Ken Burns and his brilliant team at Florentine Films has taken on one of the pillars of American culture.
And it's been months since Beyond Inclusion met with PBS President Paula Kerger and other public media decision makers.
Grace, I've wanted to talk to you for a long time. As I've thought about this meeting, this could be an interesting discussion that we have, or it could be a watershed moment.
6 months later, I can say that meeting was just an interesting discussion. For one, we still don't have the data about how BIPOC filmmakers fared in the PBS system versus white filmmakers. Also, was a watershed moment even possible?
It is particularly appropriate that we're having the discussion one day after we marked the one-year anniversary of the murder of George Floyd.
It's true that many of us saw the police murder of George Floyd as a watershed moment for racial justice.
We're not taking it anymore. It's over. It stops here.
But as we wrap up this series, I keep thinking about how many teachable moments we've lived through that we fail to learn from, that keep leading us nowhere. In late 2021, a jury declared a white teenager who crossed state lines, brought a semi-automatic rifle to a protest, and ended up killing two people, not guilty of murder. Here's what that teenager, Kyle Rittenhouse, shared in an interview after the verdict.
This case has nothing to do with race. It never had anything to do with race. It had to do with the right to self-defense.
But we all know it had everything to do with race and white privilege. This watershed moment has raised the urgency for me. I want real answers to the questions BIPOC creators have been asking PBS for decades. And if PBS doesn't want to go on the record, then we're going to find people who will, who are moving beyond just talk. Like Representative Joaquin Castro from San Antonio, Texas.
A lot of the institutions of news and entertainment that we revere as Americans are actually the largest and longest perpetrators of cultural exclusion.
As chair of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, Castro began investigating the exclusion of Latinos in U.S. media.
And then when I really put my foot on the gas was after August of 2019. When a madman drove 10 hours from Dallas, Texas to El Paso, Texas, and killed 23 people and injured more than 20 others.
Minutes before the shooting, police say Crucius allegedly uploaded an anti-immigrant manifesto on the website 8chan.
He did that because he considered these folks Hispanic invaders to Texas.
That was Castro's watershed moment. His family has been in Texas for close to a century. During that time, news and entertainment media frequently ran content that fueled suspicion and hatred against Latinos.
They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people.
There's this ugly and dirty mix between stereotypes that come out of media and then politicians in my business, really, that will take those and use them and twist them and abuse them for their own political gain.
They beat us at the border. People are flowing through. I'm going to build a wall and Mexico's going to pay for it.
Castro says he's gotten pushback for calling out media and entertainment companies on their exclusionary practices.
There's still some folks who view this as kind of a fluffy thing. Like, hey, you know, as legislators, why are we going to get involved in who's on television? It's way beyond that to me. It's a foundational issue for a community. Hollywood, and I would include public television in this, is still the main image-defining institution, I think, in the United States. And the storylines and the narratives that come out of there affect the way groups of people are viewed by their fellow Americans, and really even how communities view themselves.
Castro has been meeting with a wide range of media executives, from the New York Times and LA Times to Netflix, Amazon, Paramount, and Disney. But, he adds,
public television, I believe, has to be front and center at changing this cultural exclusion. I actually met with the head of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the head of PBS to say that as a member of Congress, Congress is watching. And the CPB receives, I think, about 70% of its funding from the American taxpayers, from the American people.
Yeah. Tell us more about that, because the president of PBS is refusing to talk to us. You met with, I guess, Paula Kerger and Pat Harrison?
Yeah, that's right.
Right?
Paula and Pat. But I made the case that there's so many talented people of color, creators, writers, editors, documentarians, and others who are reflective of America, and they need to be given an opportunity in greater number to participate. Because let's be honest, if you can't get it right at PBS or at CPB, it's going to be tough to get it right at a fully private corporation that doesn't answer in the same way to a public body, although they receive tax production credits in many states.
Tracking where this public money goes matters especially in communities that are majority BIPOC. For example, when production companies get tax breaks to film in communities of color, what are the people who live there getting in return?
And that's why I've said that many folks, including the Latino community, are really subsidizing their own exclusion. And that has to stop.
I told Congressman Castro about Heidi Rodriguez's diversity study of PBS from 2008 that the system never fully released, and how we're still asking for the same baseline data she urged PBS to track back then.
You talked about transparency and numbers being really important to establish this baseline. Is that something that Congress could mandate, that this data be released?
That's absolutely something that we should be able to get, yeah. And something that I will work to fully get. CBP, PBS, everybody needs to be able to present their numbers in a full and complete way. And Congress needs to be able to hold them accountable. Yeah, I would encourage people to reach out to me and let me know, you know, as you've navigated this process, what are the roadblocks? What are the obstacles? What needs to change in your perspective? Because we need those suggestions.
Congressman Castro's dedication to these issues is encouraging, but government, like public media, moves slowly, often painfully so. Who knows how long we'll have to wait for data that shows exactly how we're all funding our own exclusion. The system's gatekeepers have told us those numbers are hard to come by, but Tunde and I found someone who's shown that maybe it's not as hard as they thought.
My name is Darnell Hunt. I'm Dean of Social Sciences at UCLA, Professor of Sociology and African American Studies.
For close to three decades, Darnell Hunt has been researching representation in front of and behind the camera. Since 2014, he's published Diversity in Hollywood reports out of UCLA. And although they stopped tracking news and documentaries a few years ago, he shared some fascinating data about PBS scripted dramas.
There are 10 scripted titles from PBS that fell into our database for the 2019-2020 season. 100% of the show creators were white, and 70% of them were male. So only 30% were women. And for leads, the first credited actor across all 10 shows, 100% of them were white and 50% were males. Now, just to put that in context, people of color make up 42.7% of the population now. If you look at, you know, the commercial networks, ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox, et cetera, for the first time in history, people of color are actually overrepresented in their cast. So we've seen a lot of progress, you know, at least on camera, on the other networks, but almost none in PBS. I mean, PBS by far is the worst of all the broadcast networks that we look at.
Tunde and I were taken aback by Darnell Hunt's statement. We knew PBS's lack of diversity in its programming was an issue, but to hear a sociologist say it has the worst BIPOC cast representation of all the networks, it was a lot. Tunde followed up with a question.
With the knowledge that you do have regarding PBS scripted and unscripted, what questions would you ask about diversity, inclusion? If you were talking with their executives.
What goals underlie your programming decisions? Why do you have this large slate of UK produced programming as opposed to stuff that might have been produced here? I mean, is that considered to be higher quality in your view? And to what extent should diversity and inclusion considerations factor into your determination of quality?
Darnell Hunt pointed out that even the Motion Picture Academy has expanded its criteria for Best Picture Oscar to meet diversity standards, not because of political correctness, but because its leaders recognize that global movie audiences want to see themselves reflected in what they watch. Based on his research, Hunt says, PBS doesn't seem to have gotten that message.
When all of your shows are led by white people and most of the cast are overwhelmingly white, and is that quality, you know, in the context of a nation where nearly half the population is people of color? PBS is going to have to shift, else it's not going to exist. And I think that's what the fights in Washington are about right now. Like, whose America will this become? Will we hold on to your grandfather's America, where white supremacy was the unspoken but clear rule? Or will this be an America that respects and includes all of its citizens?
Researchers in many places are turning their attention to equity in media and the arts. Richard Jean So and I recently spoke on a panel at the Double Exposure Documentary Film Festival, along with Sabrina Schmidt-Gordon, another Beyond Inclusion member. So teaches at McGill University in Montreal and has studied racial inequality in publishing. One of his projects tracked the percentage of Black authors published by Penguin Random House.
Random House is kind of like PBS, an institution of cultural production. And what I find interesting about this is Toni Morrison, a famous author, was also an editor at Random House for about 15 years. And what's interesting is when she was an editor at Random House, you see the spike. There's more Black authors being published. But what's really crazy to me is as soon as she leaves, they just stop publishing Black writers. And in the social sciences, we call this effect stickiness, where basically racial inequality in culture is extremely sticky, meaning that there will be cycles of pushes for diversity, more Black editors, more Black authors, more writers of color. But it can really be as ephemeral as the tenure of a Black editor at a publishing house.
That's how entrenched whiteness can be in these institutions, So says.
But what I think the real lesson, though, is that that effect can be extremely ephemeral if the structural change isn't really permanent. I was thinking about how there are probably a number of person of color editors, writers coming and going from PBS, but the one constant is Ken Burns. And that, to me, speaks to a similar effect at Random House, where there's so much inertia over a kind of default perspective. That is going to be really hard to shake.
Richard Jean So warned us that even if we do get the requested data,
don't trust and verify, because there's not a lot of motivation for them to do a professional job doing self-audits. So I would say find other ways to potentially verify the accuracy of their material. Once you dig in, you can find other layers of inequality that can be really as profound as the headcount issue. Because institutions, when you put pressure on them, I found historically that they always want the quickest solution to make people happy, to just sort of put a band-aid over it.
During this panel, documentary filmmaker Sabrina Schmidt-Gordon mentioned that PBS had provided some stats about its on and off-screen talent, but they weren't the numbers we asked for.
We received some data back that at first glance is like, oh, look, there's over 40% of films made by people of color. But that doesn't tell the whole story. For example, I had a film that was Emmy nominated.
That film was licensed by a national series on PBS that could only pay $6,000.
For a film that took 5 years to make. If we're talking about like all these strands are featuring filmmakers of color, what are their budgets? What does that look like? That still says something about the support or the lack of support that filmmakers of color are getting.
Like Sabrina says, data can be easily manipulated or misinterpreted. Richard Jean So left us with a pro tip he learned from his Random House investigation.
I think it is important to get the best data you can from PBS, but I think there's always another way to get at the information that you're looking at that doesn't rely on the institution itself, from relatively more neutral sources.
And that's when I remembered I did have a packet of information from PBS and widely available to the public. Hey, Tunde.
Hey, Grace. How are you?
So I sent a copy to Tunde.
Good. Are you ready to do this?
So we could look over it together.
Let's make it happen.
All right. So just in time for the winter holidays, we have right here the Autumn 2021 Shop PBS catalog.
Mm. Okay. Okay.
So as you can see on the cover, there's a photo of Muhammad Ali with a headline, "Bigger Than Boxing, Larger Than Life." A film by Ken Burns, Sarah Burns, and David McMahon.
Of course. Of course it's there.
That's the cover. And then right along the bottom, you see this reminder that says, with each purchase, you're helping support public television for all. So everything in this catalog is going to support PBS.
Hmm. Television for all. You know, it's just so interesting that PBS is branding Ali's image as a Ken Burns product. It's kind of weird to see. And check out the home decor items. Like, did you see this one right here? The peacock stained glass hanging panel for $159.95, or the Amazing Grace wind chime for $79.95.
I didn't see those. That's a lot for a wind chime. But anyway, to be fair, there's less expensive things, like over here, this set of fine art gold flecked cuff bracelets for only $35. Or you can get these t-shirts that say, I'm silently correcting your grammar, or it's not gray hair, it's my silver lining. Those are only $19.95.
I like those. I like both of those.
I'll get you one.
So let's take a look at these films and documentaries, though, because this is PBS after all.
Right. Well, over on pages 22 and 23, you see 14 DVDs pictured, and 6 of the 14 are by Ken Burns, including the Civil War, the Great War, and the Vietnam War.
The classics, the classics.
And what's interesting is these are the only films on the page with hardcover companion books and Blu-ray options that are branded with the filmmaker's name.
And I see that all these Burns DVDs cost $99.99. That's kind of pricey, even if you're just a collector. It's surprising, though. Like, who's still out here watching DVDs?
Yeah, and, you know, I see that the Asian American series I worked on is also here, and it's on sale. It's marked down to $29.99, so I better stock up, right?
Yeah, holiday special, I guess.
Yeah, fire sale. Now, I'm no data whiz, but this document makes clear who PBS considers its core audience. These viewers still watch DVDs, probably even broadcast television. If they can afford these and most of the gift items, they have disposable income. If they're grammar nerds, they probably went to college. I have no conclusive evidence that says they're mostly older and white, but the dominant cultures represented here are British and European. There's tartan scarves, cookbooks on Irish pub food or Polish pierogies, and a London bobby whistle. The catalog calls it the official whistle of the London police, made in England of nickel-plated brass, complete with piercing tone. So my very unscientific study shows me that if PBS is prioritizing what it sells to a very narrow demographic, who's to say it's not doing the same with its programming? Like those British detectives who turn up on so many PBS dramas, we began this project as investigators. With each new piece of information about how public television operates, the plot thickens. We've barely begun to understand, let alone explain, all the revenue sources for public television, from pledge drives to corporate underwriting to nonprofit foundations that support specific filmmakers. But we haven't stopped seeking clarity. And in our next episode, Tunde and I will revisit the questions that led us here and look to the future.
We think about some of the best art to come out of public media. Eyes on the Prize, Soul, Sesame Street. Great things were born out of situations that were tenuous in American culture, and we're in one of those times.
This show is a production of Studio To Be and Lili Films. Our executive producers, Joaquin Alvarado, Ken Ikeda, and I, Grace Lee, created this podcast. Akintunde Ahmad is our investigative reporter. Linda Miller leads our investigative research. And Lisa Salinas is our fact checker. Cheryl Duvall is our story editor. Suzanne Reber, our consulting editor. And Olivia Elmer produces the show. Claudia Meza does our audio mixing, composition, and sound design. Thanks to her for editorial support, too. Chloe Behrens does additional production, and Mihe Jung handles project management support. Thanks also to our funders, the Ford Foundation, Just Films, and the MacArthur Foundation. And a special shout-out to Beyond Inclusion, whose organizing work this podcast builds upon. You can hear viewers like us on all your favorite podcast apps. If you'd like to support our story, please rate and review us. It really helps more people find us. Thanks for listening.